It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Rebates for home energy efficiency upgrades are becoming available through provisions in the Inflation Reduction Act. We tour through the incentives and discounts that add up to hundreds of billions of dollars that could sharply reduce the cost of home upgrades. Call in with questions about your home's energy usage, fixes you wonder about, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Kathy Kuntz is director of Dane County's Office of Energy and Climate Change. Kathy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
At the risk of overstating, Kathy, I get the impression that you've been waiting for this moment with the Inflation Reduction Act for decades that you've been working on climate initiatives. Why is this moment so incredible?
So you're right, Kate. I am super excited about this moment. You know, I've been in energy efficiency and climate action a long time. And what's really exciting here is with the coincidence of prices dropping for clean technologies. You know, folks are saying that within 2 to 3 years, electric vehicles will be cost comparable to gas vehicles. The cost of solar has dropped dramatically in the last decade. Batteries are becoming cheaper. And so we've got better economics in the market now coinciding with federal funding to really create that tipping point so that businesses, nonprofits, local governments, individuals all have the ability to invest in cleaner energy technologies and be part of this important transition.
This important transition, it's unprecedented funding for clean energy. So how do you suggest we figure out how to apply it with the complexity and the nuance? How do you apply it to our lives to ensure we don't pass up on key opportunities?
Yeah, that's making sure that people are aware of what's available is really something our office takes very seriously. You know, we've created a web page just about the tax credits through the Inflation Reduction Act. So about two-thirds of the funding under the Inflation Reduction Act is coming as tax credits. And that's good news for individuals and businesses and tax-exempt entities too, it turns out, because it's easy to access. It's a form that you fill out when you fill out your taxes where you say, oh, I got an energy audit this year. I can get a tax credit for that. I installed a more efficient heating system. I can get a tax credit for that. So the ease of at least the first wave of this is really nice because it's tax credits. Now, some of your listeners are thinking, well, what does Kathy mean? A nonprofit or a school can't get a tax credit. That maybe one of the most exciting things Congress did here is they invented something new they're calling direct pay, where a non-taxable entity, so a school or a nonprofit doesn't file federal taxes, but now under the IRA, they can say, we did this solar project, and they can get a check back from U.S. Treasury for solar or geothermal or batteries up to 30% of the cost of their project. So a substantial piece of money for a single form.
And so do you see that there are limits of direct pay? I mean, what should we also take into consideration here?
So the only sort of caveat that on the direct pay is for local government. So for us at Dane County, if we fund a project through tax-exempt bonds, we can only claim a 15% credit on that project, not a 30% credit, because a tax-exempt bond is already a benefit from the federal government. Other than that, Kate, there are no maximums here. So, and the tax credits are in place for 10 years. So that means that an entity, a school or a nonprofit, think about a faith community, it's unrealistic to think that a school or a faith community is going to go from thinking about solar to installing solar in a year or even a year and a half. It's going to take them a little time to go through the planning process. And the good news is they have the assurance that these tax credits will be available when they need them. So so it's a market certainty that I think, as much as anything else, is a real benefit here.
Kathy Kuntz, director of Dane County's Office of Energy and Climate Change, as we look at the Inflation Reduction Act tax credits available for clean energy products and projects, and especially for homeowners. Call in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, hi.
Hi. As individual homeowners, we have a home, an all-electric home in southern Wisconsin in Jefferson County, and our average fuel bills there in the winter are $400 or $500 a month. We also have acreage available that would be suitable for a solar installation. I'm wondering, are these credits available? We're not well-to-do. We're middle class. But are these credits available to middle class people? By that, I mean people who have less than $100,000 a year. I'll stop there and just see what the first step is and what we should be considering.
Rich, thank you. Kathy?
Yeah, that's a terrific example, Rich, because you're right. A solar installation there in an all-electric home would just dramatically reduce those energy bills. So the 30% tax credit is real there. There are actually adders onto that. You might get a credit higher than that if the panels are domestically made and some other things. I think you point to a really, maybe the one challenge we have left here is that is the financing piece. Because of course, a tax credit is going to be a thing you claim on your taxes after the project is done. So there is a need for upfront financing. In the business sector, we have a tool in Wisconsin called Property Assessed Clean Energy, where you can take a loan against the property that that essentially pays for itself in the energy savings. We don't have a parallel program on the residential side, but there are green mortgage products that could do an equivalent thing there. Where you could finance the solar in a way that the savings on the energy bill were greater than your mortgage payments for that. So that, I think the financing is the piece, Rich, that, you know, the tax credit is there for you, but it may be a challenge to finance the front part of that.
I think it also elevates the numbers from Rewiring America, this nonprofit that provides a look at the discount estimates. And it says a two-person household with Wisconsin's median income of $67,000 would be eligible for about $18,000 in tax incentives and discounts. Can you look at that top line? How could homeowners use discounts to fund projects? What would be available?
Yeah, and the important thing to know about the Rewiring America calculator is it's talking about the tax credits that we were just talking about, but also two still pending federally funded programs. So there'll be additional federal grants for electrification of homes and for efficiency. We don't expect those programs to be up and running until 2024.
Okay.
So there's a little bit of what we know right now through the tax credits. And then, but to Rich's point, those federal programs that are coming are targeted at low and moderate income households. So they're targeted at households at or below 150% of median area income. So that's a pretty good number in most of Wisconsin, that median area income, 150% of that. So those programs coming in 2024 are definitely going to help another cohort of households afford projects.
Kathy Kuntz, decades of experience helping residents and businesses adopt sustainable practices. Call in with your questions about energy upgrades to your home through the Inflation Reduction Act policies, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Governor Tony Evers' goal is 100% carbon-free electricity consumption by 2050. We explore how the Inflation Reduction Act could help with sustainability and green initiatives here at home. Call in with questions about energy usage in your life, what policies you wonder about, 800-642-1234. Kathy Kuntz is director of the Office of Energy and Climate Change for Dane County. Kathy, let's spend more time here on electric vehicles. We see the demand going up and up for EVs, and the demand comes in part from the Inflation Reduction Act's overhaul of EV tax credits. How are electric vehicle taxes different after the law?
Yeah, it's a great question. So what the Inflation Reduction Act did is, prior to that, EV tax credits were limited by manufacturer. When a particular auto manufacturer like General Motors hit 200,000 vehicle sales, the credits started going down. And under the Inflation Reduction Act, there remains a $7,500 credit on electric vehicles. It is tied now, though, to how the battery and battery components are sourced and assembled. So there's a push to, over time, give the whole credit to vehicles that are more American made. So the complexity of this is the Department of Energy, and there's a link on our website to this, has a list of the vehicles that qualify for the tax credit. So that list of vehicles is going to evolve. What we're seeing already is manufacturers citing additional battery plants in the U.S. to qualify for the credit. The other thing that happens in the IRA, though, is there's a $4,000 tax credit for buying a used electric vehicle. Hmm. And that could be a game changer. You know, I often say to folks, the way lots of people are going to come into the electric vehicle market is by buying a used EV. You know, it's actually how my family came into the market. We decided our second car would be a used EV as a way to sort of learn this market, you know, and we got a good deal on a used EV. And within, I think, 6 to 8 months, we decided to sell our gas car and just have the EV because we liked it so much. That used EV part is going to be really important because it expands who can be in this market. The other innovation around electric vehicles that's important is, starting in 2024, car dealerships are going to be able to take the tax credit off the purchase price. Hmm. So to that point we were making before about, but you have to carry this debt, you'll be able to actually get that discount right at the dealership when you buy the vehicle. And that is going to be, a tremendous benefit for folks to have that $7,500 discount just happen right there when they're purchasing a vehicle.
What about having to charge the EV at home and having to install either an electrical panel box or an upgrade to your wiring?
Yeah, so the grants that we mentioned that are coming in 2024 are going to help fund some of those electrical upgrades if you need them. The thing I tell prospective EV owners, though, is you should first figure out what you really need. You know, if you're doing a typical car in Wisconsin commutes less than 40 miles a day, you can trickle charge that at home in your garage. You don't need an EV charger to, if that's how much you're driving, kind of thing. So the, like anything that's new, you know, we've got some adaptive pieces that need to happen here. I think really at the end of the day, EV charging is no more complicated than keeping your smartphone charged. Hmm. And, you know, it's, if you think about your phone, there are days when you do certain things on your phone and you use it a lot and you know you're going to need to charge it more, and certain days where you don't even need to charge it at all because you didn't use it very much. It's the same sort of thing. The human brain can do this.
Let's bring in Jim in River Falls. Jim, hi. What's your question?
Hi. Thanks for your program. Yeah. About 10 years ago, I put in a photovoltaic array, but I was working then, and I'm retired now, and I'm just wondering if I wanted to, add some capacity for solar. If incomes are lower, will these credits for tax refunds extend over more than a one-year period? I'm just wondering, with the expense, if you would be able to, if your income's below, a certain amount, whether it would work to get those tax credits. If your income is $50,000 to $60,000, if you'd be able to take advantage of the full credits on those things.
It's a great question, Jim. And yes, this is true of the renewable energy credits. It's not true of the energy efficiency credits, but the renewable energy credits, you can roll over into future tax years. So essentially what Jim is saying is maybe he ends up with a $5,000 tax credit, but his tax bill is only $4,000. Well, then that would wipe out his tax bill this year and carry $1,000 of credit into the next year for his tax bill. So yes, that is totally doable under the IRA.
We're talking about tax credits for homeowners for clean energy products with Kathy Kuntz, Director of Dane County's Office of Energy and Climate Change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. I want to just bring up renters for a moment. How do these federal incentives apply to renters?
Yeah, it's a great question. So obviously the electric vehicle incentives can apply, and we're seeing more and more apartments that accommodate EV charging, which is good. On the facility side for renters, the new programs that will come in 2024 are all, they're targeted at homeowners or landlords. So there's good potential, I think, for us to work with landlords around getting some of those buildings upgraded under the new programs that have more grant funding. The other thing to mention is through the infrastructure bill, sort of in 2021, there were increased funding for our low-income weatherization assistance program, which does home energy upgrades to homes below a certain income level across the state. And so that program got an infusion of additional funding too. So we'll be expanding what it's doing in conjunction with these new programs.
If landlords, though, do take advantage of these energy upgrade incentives, that is positive, but how do you ensure they don't pass on the cost of the renovations to renters in the form of raising rent?
Yeah, this is a very real challenge. And so there's nothing in the IRA that would prevent that from happening. There, I can tell you that local governments across Wisconsin, we're talking about all of this because we have ambitious local climate goals. One in three people in Wisconsin live in a community with ambitious climate goals. And a group of us communities are talking to each other about how to maybe secure some of the competitive federal funding to do more in that affordable housing realm, where we would put requirements on the funding so that rents couldn't rise when energy costs went down. But that's still a little bit in evolution, but it's definitely an issue we're all paying attention to.
We're short on time here, but what challenges are you hearing from homeowners attempting to receive tax incentives and discounts? What are the barriers right now?
So I think the biggest barrier right now is actually awareness. It's not so much accessing it, but, there was a poll recently and one in three registered voters in the U.S. have never heard of the Inflation Reduction Act. So we know we need to do more to make folks aware that there are these opportunities out there so that they're ready to take advantage of them.
Kathy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Kathy Kuntz is director of Dane County's Office of Energy and Climate Change. We have a link to the office's Inflation Reduction Act landing page where you can find how to take advantage of these tax credits and incentives, find the link at WPR.org/mornings. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Museums and universities around the country hold the remains of tens of thousands of Indigenous people in their collections. Decades after a federal law seeks their return to tribal nations, we learn about ProPublica's repatriation project tracking. Come into the conversation about repatriation, questions about institutions and government agencies holding human remains. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Ash New is a reporter, designer, and developer with ProPublica's news app team. Ash, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Good morning. And Mary Huditz is a ProPublica reporter focusing on tribal issues throughout the Southwest. Mary, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let's take stock, Mary, of the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act. More than 30 years after the passage, what has your investigation found?
Our investigation has found that in the past 30 years under NAGPRA, that more roughly 600 institutions still hold more than 100,000 human remains taken from Native American grave sites. And just fewer than half of what institutions originally reported holding has been returned to tribes for a variety of reasons.
What are those variety of reasons? Why have some museums and universities made little headway on this work?
There's a range of answers to that. I think we often hear, I believe even including from institutions in Wisconsin, that NAGPRA is complicated, that it is expensive. It is that way, I think, for tribes as well, we've been told. And then in addition, I think a lot of institutions, which is a part of our work and our investigation, have determined that most of the remains that institutions still hold under NAGPRA have been declared culturally unidentifiable, which means that the institution has determined that they cannot decide which and if a present day tribe can be the the recipient of these collections under the law. So that they cannot determine a tie between the human remains, the ancestors, and the tribes today.
So those remains stay very much in limbo in that situation. Ash, how does Wisconsin compare to other states?
So I think we can look at Wisconsin from the institutional perspective. So what are the institutions that are based in Wisconsin doing? And we can also look at it from the other sort of slightly different perspective, which is what are institutions that have remains taken from what is now present day Wisconsin? What are they doing with the remains that they have reported? Kind of on both of those metrics, the Midwest region in general, there's a history of displacement. There's a history of sort of burial mounds in the area being excavated, having remains taken, looted from those regions. And so in Wisconsin, what the records are saying is that about 36% of the more than 3,300 Native American remains that were taken from the state, only 36% have been made available for return to tribes. And that compared to, other states like perhaps Alaska, Hawaii, some of the Pacific Northwest states is relatively low. And there's a, like Mary was saying, there's a variety of reasons for that.
Let's bring on a call now, Aaron in Oshkosh. Aaron, what would you like to raise?
Yes, hello, and good. Thank you for taking my call. I've been listening to a couple of these shows that you've been doing recently, and frankly, I'm just dumbfounded and alarmed by the number of remains that they're saying are culturally unidentifiable when we have genetic testing at our disposables available for us to use so easily these days. So what's the situation there?
Aaron, thank you. Mary, why not genetic testing and other technological advancements here?
Yeah, so I have a couple of answers or thoughts in response to that question. Say about genetic testing specifically, there are limited instances where it has occurred, but on NAGPRA collections, very, very often tribes actually are opposed to ancient DNA analysis. It was a very destructive approach to researching remains. It has, I believe, become less destructive in recent years, but still is. And then in addition, NAGPRA doesn't require institutions. It's in the law to conduct additional research to determine who to repatriate to. And then third, I think in regards to the question about the culturally identifiable label overall, a lot of these remains actually come with information. So they're determined culturally identifiable a lot of times, even though there is clear geographic information, where exactly they came from. I think the items that individuals are buried with sometimes can provide information about cultural ties to the present. And then tribes themselves also have an understanding of where they come from, their histories. And so, yes, the genetic and DNA analysis does exist now, but there's also a lot of information that is available to institutions to make determinations without doing analysis.
I want to look at one institution in particular, Ash. Milwaukee Public Museum has in your database the 19th largest collection of unrepatriated Native remains in the country, at least 1,600 not available to tribes. What does that mean when museums don't make them available for return?
Yeah, so that phrasing, what we mean by that is they haven't gone through the NAGPRA process. They haven't filed what is called a notice of inventory completion that would list out which tribes are determined to either be culturally affiliated or through another process called disposition, sort of determined to be the tribes to which the museum will transfer the remains.
So you're saying that because that process hasn't started, you use that language, not available for a return.
Yeah. So, you know, after these notices are completed for some institutions, it still might take months, even years, for the physical repatriation of those remains to happen. Depending on resources, sometimes the tribes aren't able to find land or an appropriate site to rebury or have other sort of conflicts with arranging the transportation of these remains, potentially over, you know, thousands of miles, as some tribes are not located in the same areas where the museums are.
Ash New is with us, and Mary Hudetz are reporters with ProPublica as we talk about the return of ancestral remains and their repatriation project, what it has seen. You can join in the conversation, your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Mary, you mentioned that repatriation is costly. What are some of the costs that universities and museums would, and state agents, government agencies would incur?
On the institutional side, I think it's often, you know, sort of reviewing your collections and the time that might take to sort of decide you know, if it can be culturally, if remains can be affiliated to a tribe. And then occasionally, I'm not sure actually what institutions might incur with tribal travel, but they might bring in Native people from specific tribes to have meetings and consultation about the remains that they hold or the collections that they hold. So that can be part of the tribe. I think where we see a lot of, I think tribes like to also note that they incur quite a bit of cost as well. Mm-hmm. And they do it, you know, that cost adds to their larger budgets of providing, you know, for their people, like, you know, basic services that any government should and can provide. And so that also can be costly, and they're traveling to these institutions often from different corners of the country to review collections and try to make claims. And they also do their own research too of geographic information, available archaeological information.
I thought it was interesting and noticed some variation between remains versus returning funerary objects. Why might a museum hold on to remains but return more objects from the collection?
That, I think sometimes there could be a couple answers to that. I think one is often there's also something called unaffiliated funerary objects. It's a very technical term, which essentially means that maybe items that are known to be taken from graves are not affiliated with it. The institution no longer knows which individual they might have been buried with. I think that's just one answer. I think that's a big question. And then I think in addition to that, I'm not sure. I guess there's just a lot more I could add, but I wonder what your next question might be.
Sure. Ash, go ahead.
I would also add that with the funerary objects, sometimes it's the other way around. Sometimes the remains get returned, but the funerary objects do not. And that's sort of, we have seen situations where museums have split up collections or, you know, remains from the funerary belongings that were buried with them. So maybe one museum has the remains, the other museum has the belongings, and they make different determinations as to what to do with each of those.
So it's not necessarily the funerary object staying with the remains in all cases.
Yeah, sometimes, unfortunately, they do get split up. And, you know, with the historical records, it can be difficult to piece together what came from where and what goes with what.
We're learning about ProPublica's repatriation project with a pair of journalists from the newsroom. We have Ash New and Mary Hudetz. Share your questions, your views on repatriation. What surprises you about Native ancestral remains? 800-642-1234 is the number to call in. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. An ongoing ProPublica investigation and its searchable database monitors Native American remains in the possession of federally funded institutions around the country that have yet to be returned to tribes. Add your voice to this issue of repatriation and the holding on to human remains of thousands of Indigenous people in collections. Call in with questions at this number, 800-642-1234. We have ProPublica investigative journalists Mary Hudetz and Ash New with us. Let's bring in Mary now in Lake Geneva. Mary, hi. What is your question?
Hi. I'm wondering, we're talking about institutions returning and repatriating items, but what about private collections? There's a lot of people that collect things, you know, pick up things, buy things. I think there's a trading network online maybe about these things, and how would an individual go about trying to repatriate any items?
Mary, thank you. Mary Hudetz, would you like to respond there?
Sure. Yeah, it's a good question. So I would just note real quick from the front end, our investigation very much focused on institutions because of the data that we had available, the records, and the law also gave us sort of a clear framework for accountability to see how repatriations should go or might go. As far as private collections go, that is not governed by the law. NAGPRA only applies to federally funded institutions. There are, some laws in place that might decide, it's no longer legal to collect from Native American grave sites, for instance. However, families may have items in their possession that that come from a time that preceded laws that outlaw that sort of trafficking and
have you found in your own reporting that the private marketplaces and the issue of the remains being in private hands is that an equally concerning thing?
I think for tribal nations it very often can be. I'm in the Southwest, and I think there's a lot of concern here about at least recent relatively recent grave looting that has occurred. And then also, I think, there have been items that were maybe purchased or sold or taken out of tribal communities many, many decades ago, and that tribes understand to be sacred or belong to their entire community and do want returned to them. And that end, I think I have seen some diplomacy sort of approaches among tribes, or at least one in particular where I live, to seek the return of an item. And then also I think tribes do very often review like foreign auction houses, catalogs or different catalogs to see what may be out there that belongs to them. A lot of conversation on that front too.
Ash, can you explain how universities and museums came to amass so many Native remains in the first place?
It's a wide variety of methods. The institutions that we've been looking at, in large part, there's a few phases in the history of the country that led to the accumulation of these Native American remains. The first one that we discuss in sort of one of our main stories is that institutions in kind of the 1800s were just starting back then to try and like amass something that we call encyclopedic collections. So they were really trying to compete with one another and trying to sort of collect what they could from all across the country, competing with museums in Europe as well to try and get the most prestigious collections. And that's when we see a lot of the sort of before archaeology and anthropology established themselves as relatively academic fields. It was much more of a Wild West scenario, people just taking, looting, stealing from battlefields and that sort of thing. And then in the next sort of phase, we see something of the professionalization of archaeology and anthropology in the country. There were a lot of federally sponsored excavations in tandem with infrastructure projects, big dams being built, highways, other kinds of large infrastructure projects in the Tennessee area. The TVA, the Tennessee Valley Authority, has a large number of remains from WPA, sort of Great Depression era excavations that were done in that time frame. And then you, after that, sort of see a slowdown. There's a variety of other sort of miscellaneous ways that remains have come into the hands of museums. A lot of private donors have donated or given their remains and collections to museums. And that's another way that we see museums sort of garner a motley of remains from very different sources with different provenance as well.
I want to turn now to burial mounds. Mary, the ProPublica Repatriation Project investigated as well places that are built on Native burial mounds. What did your investigation show about ancient burial mounds?
Yeah, I think our colleague Logan Jaffe actually did a really in-depth, important piece on burial, a certain burial mound in Illinois. But the answer to your question goes, I think, back a little bit, at least in part, to something Ash noted really early. Burial mounds are very much are something we see were built in like the Midwest, the Southeast, parts of the country where tribes were forcibly removed from by the United States during, you know, U.S. Western expansion. And so that's, I think, a large portion of what we see in our data does come from burial mounds. At least in part, one answer could be that it has to do with removal, the fact that tribes are no longer living where their ancestors, these ancestors had been buried. And then that has complicated, or institutions have seen that as complicating the process of repatriation, because repatriation is very much about tribes explaining, having a sense of place and knowing where they came from and knowing where their ancestors had also lived and been buried.
Ash, where does the database go from here, and what are the next steps for reporting on the repatriation project?
So one thing that we've seen with the release of this database is that a number of museums and institutions have sought to update their records with the federal program that manages them. A lot of these museums and institutions, maybe they submitted records in the 90s and haven't updated them since. And so we've gotten a few messages saying that they're planning on updating their data, and can we please update the database once they do that? And so we're looking to update our database probably in the next couple of weeks or so to give people a more revised and fresh set of numbers. And then I think in the future, you know, we have a couple of more stories planned to be published focusing on specific institutions that we've identified in our reporting.
Yeah, keep the work going. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you.
Ash New is a reporter, designer, and developer. Mary Hudetz is a reporter focusing on tribal issues throughout the Southwest, both lead reporters in ProPublica's investigation into returning ancestral remains to Native tribes. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.